spark plug. Oh, spark plug. Oh, spark plug. Oh, spark plug. I have a girl. Beverly is her name. She drinks coffee. Spark plug is its name. Any other coffee is truly just not the same. It's not the same.
It's a hit!
Nashville lives on.
Listeners, have you switched to Sparkplug Coffee yet? Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica fair trade beans. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf, half-calf, and a rotating seasonal blend if you like to shake it up. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this amazing coffee to you in Canada or the US within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor, and you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug as you need it or join the Sparkplug Autopilot Coffee Club. The Autopilot Coffee Club is not a coffee of the month club. It's completely personalized and flexible. It comes with all kinds of member benefits, all the convenience, none of the commitment. And if you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, that's all one word with the number 100, Sparkplug is offering 20% off your next coffee order. That applies to any size order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. So what are you waiting for? It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Well, let's go with the podcast after the music.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hola, amigos, and muchas gracias for downloading the 354th edition of the Top 100 Project. This week, the Ellis's analysis takes us to Pacoima as we jabber about La Bamba. We're going to spoil, so vamoose if you aren't prepared for that. I'm the mean drunk who sadly shouts his brother's name while standing on a bridge. Mijo, Ryan Ellis. And here's the lady with the flying guitar who won a coin toss she really wishes she'd lost. My wife, Kitten Bev.
That's me.
I was going to call one of us high tone, but neither of us is dignified, nor do we have high principles.
Just a pair of scoundrels we are.
I thought high tone referred to his music taste, and that's why they called him that early on. Then he actually refers to it when he talks to Donna. But I looked it up during the movie, and that's what it says online, that it means dignified, high principles, aiming for better kind of deal.
Oh, yeah. I also assumed it was a music thing.
Makes more sense, doesn't it? But in a way, it's saying you're snooty. But then he calls himself that. So either he doesn't know what it means either, or he doesn't mind being called.
He's just owning the insult.
Then again, he loves his family. He's not somebody who says, I don't want to be in this anymore. He really loves his entire family, including his hard-to-deal-with older brother, Bob. Okay, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture. What does La Bamba mean in English?
I was going to make the joke first that it translates to...
Donna?
No. The Bamba? But that's actually what it translates to, basically. The Bamba is a word that doesn't really have an English translation. It loosely means to shake, to dance, to gyrate.
Well, that's what I saw was to shake or to stomp.
Yes, to stomp. Yeah, yeah, I saw that too.
When he plays it for the first time in front of a big audience, not the end of the movie, because I don't think it really sings in that sequence when they're in Iowa, and then, of course, they all go into a plane and die. But when he first plays it, in the movie at least, is the very first time in front of an audience, did you notice how many people don't have rhythm? Now, they've never heard the song before, or if they've heard it, they haven't heard him do it this way before. That's the whole point. I'm going to do it different than you've heard in Mexican weddings and things. But I watched the clip again today because I just wanted to hear the song. I was actually also comparing Richie Valens actually singing versus Los Lobos' cover. I think he does as good a job, if not better, with Donna and with Come On, Let's Go. But I prefer Los Lobos' version of La Bamba. It's not that different, but I think they do a little better job of it. So anyway, when he does play that show, so many people are... What if the beat should be... It'd be more like beat, beat, with either hand claps or snaps or whatever. But a bunch of white people, too, so maybe that's part of the problem.
Well, part of the problem is probably that they were on a movie set and they were either working with a click track or maybe they weren't. Sometimes they just don't even know which song they're going to be dancing to. Although in this movie, they definitely should have known the rhythm of the song that they were going to dance to before they were shooting this scene. Because obviously it's going to be La Bamba, but sometimes that can just get messed up in editing, too. Although I'm an editor and I've edited dance scenes before, and you just keep trimming until you get them on rhythm.
Mm-hmm. Or show less of them. The whole point is they all get excited right away for a song they don't really know that well, and it becomes a hit instantly. But I think we get the gist. Stop showing these lame-ass white people with no rhythm.
The song's a jam, that's why.
Terrific song. It was nominated for the top 100 songs for the AFI list, and it should have made it. It's a great song. Everyone knows it from this film. I've talked about the songs, those being crap, and it really is. They've got so many wrong choices or wrongly placed choices. Okay, Let's Go, the original title of the movie, in production at least, was released by Columbia Pictures on July 24th, 1987. We picked it because we wanted to cover a Hispanic film for once. We haven't really done that many. Maybe we haven't done any. We've had Hispanic characters in the movies before, but not that many about them. And this really is that. We'll get to that a little later on.
It probably depends on your definition of Hispanic. Pan's Labyrinth is obviously a Hispanic film.
Traffic has a lot of Mexican characters. Yeah, okay. Yeah. But this is their movie because the director, the writer, and most of the people involved are not white Americans. La Bamba did very well, especially considering the studio didn't put that much money into making it. In fact, it was the number one hit for Columbia that year, even ahead of the Best Picture winner that they produced, The Last Emperor. All right, Bev, for those who forget what this 33-year-old movie is about, give him the skinny, please, on La Bamba. The stomp, the shake.
The Bamba.
The Bamba.
Lou Diamond Phillips is Richard Steven Valenzuela, the Mexican-American teenager who became Richie Valens, the rock star, in the late 50s. The film follows Richie from his humble roots with his devoted mother and troublemaking older brother to his burgeoning music career that ended just as it was beginning when Richie was killed in the same tragic plane crash that took Buddy Holly and the Big Bopper. The day the music died.
Mm-hmm. Or, in a nutshell, do you think Bob kept up with his drawing?
I was actually wondering that when I was doing my research for the film. Kind of curious what happened to Bob after this.
His real name is Bob Morales, and the actor playing him is Isai Morales. That was just a coincidence, because the other garbage man says when he picks up the Woody Woodpecker drawings, Morales, get moving or something, and then people point out, oh, that's an error, that's the actor's last name. Well, that's actually his last name, because Steven Valenzuela, who drank himself to death, that's Richie's dad, and I guess the other three kids must be all Steven's kids. But Bob is Connie's son from a previous marriage. I guess he's supposed to be quite a bit older than Richie, because Richie is 16 when the movie starts and 17 when he died. Bob has got to be, I think, at least in his 20s.
He's been to prison. Not that you can't send teenagers to prison.
But... And apparently Connie turned him in as well. Okay, the Rotten Tomatoes numbers. 91% of critics like this film. 39 fresh, only 4 rotten, for an average of 6.9 out of 10. So I guess those who liked it didn't rave about it, they just liked it. And it had 78% of audiences on its side. It was 15th at the 1987 U.S. box office. Three Men and a Baby was number one. Moonstruck, which we covered quite a few years ago, was number 5. And Dirty Dancing, which we covered last year, was number 11. And I don't think I mentioned this in a while. The National Film Registry, so the Library of Congress, La Bamba was put in there in 2017 along with some big movies we've covered before. Spartacus, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, Titanic, all made the AFI list. They were all put in that year. Along with Die Hard, Field of Dreams, and Memento, which we've covered but weren't AFI films. Although those three are better than the other three.
Agreed.
By a lot, in fact, I think. And I mentioned that it was nominated for the Top 100 Songs for the American Film Institute. Okay, we haven't seen this movie in a long time, you said. I have seen it lots of times over the years and knew it well. I wouldn't say it's perfect, but I do like it quite a bit. What about Beverly Ellis? Beverly Ellis.
It's really a simple and straightforward movie in the best way. It avoids all of the cliche rock star biopic traps that drive me crazy. I love that it focuses really on his relationship with his family, specifically his brother. And it really paints this lovely, down-to-earth picture of Valenzuela's life. And Lou Diamond Phillips is off the charts endearing. He really makes the film. I know there's some controversy with his casting, but it's hard to imagine the film without him.
You mean because he wasn't Mexican?
Yeah, he's not even Hispanic, really.
And it says in the film, I guess this is real, Richie didn't speak Spanish. Bob does when they're with the snake guy in the middle of the movie when he gets that charm, the talisman, I should say. He mentioned earlier in the film he can't speak Spanish, so Bob has to translate for him.
But it's not even just that he's not Mexican. He's Filipino.
Oh, right, so the actual actor, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, part so people Filipino have accused him of playing brown face.
And part Cherokee as well. So when he was a native in Young Guns, Navajo, they're always calling him that, in the first film at least. That was more honest to what he is, because he is part Cherokee. But no, he's not actually Mexican. Morales has Puerto Rican roots. Rosana de Soto, who plays their mother, Connie, is Mexican, or has Mexican roots anyway. And Elizabeth Pena, who plays Rosie, has Cuban roots. She died only 5 or 6 years ago as well. I forgot about that. Looking up her roots, I saw, yeah, Elizabeth Pena died. Didn't do a ton of big movies, but this is a pretty good one for her. They're all so realistic, actually. I'm a little bit surprised that Isai Morales and Lou Diamond Phillips, I guess Phillips to a degree became a star, but not as much as he could have been. But Isai Morales is the one that surprises me the most because he's got, I think, the most interesting role in the whole movie. I think he's outstanding. He's worked all this time. He was really good in a pretty small role, as it turns out. Spoiler alert, I guess a little too late now. On Ozark, I thought he'd be the antagonist in the whole show. He looks so good, too. He's such a great-looking dude as an older man in that show.
He looks so much hotter in his middle age than he does in La Bamba.
But he never became much of a star. Phillips, to a degree. The two women in this movie weren't in a lot of big things. Now, is that racism? Pena probably had the... yeah, probably. Pena probably had the most... I don't know about an impressive career, because Phillips probably did overall. But she worked plenty. There's not a lot of credits for Rosanna DeSoto, and I think she's really good as their mother. She's not that much older than either of them, the actress versus the actors. But anyway, she does a good job as their mother.
Yeah, I'm not proud to say that I really hadn't thought about that this much before we decided to do this film and talk about Hispanic films. I struggle to even think of that many films that I would consider to be Hispanic films. Other than the really obvious ones, like this, like Amores Perros, like Desperado, stuff like that. I don't think it had ever really dawned on me just how poorly represented they are when you consider that Hispanic, Latino Americans, they make up 18% of the population of America. I had to look that up for this, and I was astounded to think almost 1 in 5 Americans call themselves Hispanic or Latino, Latina. How often do you see movies with Hispanic American stories, or even just how often are they cast, period? And even worse when you consider that Hollywood is part of LA, and a lot more than 18% of LA is Hispanic.
The only thing I will say in Hollywood's defense about that is you looked up numbers that are 33 years in the future from when this movie was made. 1987, I'm sure those numbers weren't quite like that.
Okay, that's fair.
But there were enough people in their country, and there are enough stories to tell as well. El Norte is another movie you could have mentioned. I maybe don't know about that one. That was nominated for the AFI list, I believe, too, even though I think of it as a Hispanic or I think Mexican film. I haven't seen it in a long time. The director does a commentary where he says El Norte probably 412 times. It's actually kind of cute. Of course, that means the North. Lou Diamond Phillips, and his real name, by the way, is Lou Diamond Upchurch, but his stepdad is Phillips. Because I thought for sure Diamond had to be made up, but it says on the IMDb, Lou Diamond Upchurch is his real name.
Phillips is the made-up name.
No, it's his dad's.
Well, yeah, it's his stepdad's. Yeah, that's... name.
But if this is considered brownface, that was way more common back then. Look at the way that people did it in the 50s. Natives were almost always played by white men or white women wearing bronzer. The main villain in The Searchers, I'm pretty sure, is a white guy. Name almost every movie that have natives in them. And at least the lead is going to be some white American actor. But otherwise, the casting is pretty good. It doesn't look that much like Richie. Again, looking up those songs, the thumbnail when I listened to Donna and La Bamba. He doesn't look that much like him at all.
No, he really doesn't.
But that isn't that big a deal. I don't look up the rest of the family.
It's wild to actually look at pictures of Richie Valens right before he died, because another miscast with Lou Diamond Phillips, and this always annoys me, but I sympathize with casting directors in this regard, that they cast a 24-year-old to play a 16-year-old. Bugs me always. But when you see the actual Richie Valens, he looks like a kid. It really accentuates the tragedy of his death.
I wouldn't say Phillips looks like he can retire next year, but he feels like he could pass for even older than 24.
Yeah, they even wrote in a line wisely when Bob comes back from prison and they're running up the hill and he's like, look at you, you are so big for 16 years old. Yeah, no 16-year-old looks like that.
Well, unless they're an athlete a lot of times. Chris and I have talked about this in many movies, especially the high school sports movies, where they cast people in their 20s. That bothers him every time. I don't know if I've ever actually said to him the reason why they probably do. Two reasons, actually. Maybe 12 reasons, but two I can think of. One is that you want to have the experienced actor that you can rely on, who's maybe done 10, 12, 40 things before. And the other reason is if you get somebody young enough, then you can't work with them as much as you can with an adult.
This is why I'm totally sympathetic to casting directors that have to like work under these parameters. Yeah, I don't want you to cast a 24-year-old to play a 16-year-old, but at the same time, it's really hard to work with a 16-year-old for all kinds of reasons. Yeah. So I'm sympathetic.
Well, at least the filmmakers, the people behind the camera, the writer-director, Luis Valdez, does have Chicana roots, it says online there. And his parents were migrant workers, which is the way the movie starts.
That's actually one of my favorite things about the movie. I think it sets a beautiful scene of what their life was like.
They took your yams!
Oh, please.
That was going to be the nutshell. Fruit picker dies in Iowa, and justice is served because they took your yams and bought two guitars with it. And they're nice-looking guitars, too.
Well, a guitar can be nice-looking and actually be a trash guitar, so it's hard to say.
Okay. Probably used.
Oh, yeah, totally.
But he has a green one. He has one that's a creamy white. I love the creamy white one.
The big one. I can't remember what it's called. Metal, kind of. But I really love that it illustrated life as a migrant farm worker. Although, I say migrant, but he was born in America. And he's still living in these camps, sleeping in a tent, working really hard.
He took his own job.
You get the impression of what their life was like, and they work really, really hard. And then even when they got out of there and they moved on up, it was to homes that, let's face it, people like you and I would consider an abject failure of a life to end up raising a family in a house the size of an RV.
The house is a little bit bigger than the RV, but yeah, that's where Bob and Rosie are, is the RV.
Right.
And then Connie and all the kids, so Richie and the other three young kids.
And you really feel that space. I don't know if they actually got cameras in there, how they did it, but the low ceilings and the smaller than normal doors, all those little details really add to setting the stage and creating a world that, to me, when I saw this movie in 87 and even now in 2020, I haven't really had many windows into this world of working class immigrants in Southern California, obviously.
Well, Valdez then shot a lot of what he knew, and his brother was an associate producer. Sometimes that means you're given a token job. Like in State and Maine, that's one of the running gags. People get made associate producers and they are only getting it because they have to keep quiet about something or what have you. But sometimes an associate producer is a huge part of the behind the scenes stuff. And it sounds like Daniel Valdez really was. Bill Borden, who I don't know, but then Taylor Hackford, who did Ray, and before this had done Officer and a Gentleman and a lot of big movies. They were the producers, and I didn't read too much online about Hackford being involved or not being involved.
I think he was supposed to direct before Valdez got it.
Okay, and I wonder if he was pressured off the project, because that didn't happen that much back then. Spike Lee did that to Norman Jewison with Malcolm X, but then Norman Jewison did not get bullied off of doing The Hurricane. But Spike Lee was a bigger name than, obviously, Luis Valdez was. Apart from doing some TV, the only other movie he ever directed, and I say in the past tense because this was 1981, it's called Zoot Suit. I know the answer to this question, but how does a guy who makes a movie that was a pretty damn solid hit, and the studio's biggest hit of the year, bigger than your Best Picture winner,
on a small budget even,
on a very small budget, not get any more directing gigs? I think it's because his last name was Valdez.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a shame, because he directed a very solid movie, very somber, too, surprisingly so. I know the movie well, so I wasn't surprised by that. Maybe you were. It's not a musical, but still in some ways it is, and most musicals are more fun. Chicago is a very dark film. A lot of awful things going on in that, but it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
There's dark stuff going on in this movie, too, and I like it quite a bit, but it's not that much fun that much of the time. When he plays La Bamba, yeah, that's a great sequence.
Big time.
And the sequence where he sings, let's go, and does that 40 times in the studio, that's always been funny to me. And even though Isai Morales is great in the film, he's a bring down on their family. But then again, he's a little bit manic depressive. Obviously, it's because of the booze more than anything else. But he does have high highs and low lows. Doesn't have very many creamy middles.
Whereas Richie is all creamy middles.
The rock solid member of the family.
It's possible that as everybody remembered him, they put him on a pedestal, which is what often happens when people die, especially when they die young. And he was only 17. He didn't really have a chance to live his life and to make choices for himself. So it could just be like a flattering portrait of him.
That's true.
But it doesn't feel phony. The biggest strength of this movie is it has this real authenticity. It feels so sincere, and there are so many details about it that give it a real verisimilitude. You were talking about the kids that couldn't dance very well. Well, when they cast the extras, they cast pretty young people, and they cast normal-looking people. And then they put them in normal outfits, and some of their shirts were wrinkly, and some of the wardrobe looked like it had been worn through, and it just felt like that's probably what it really looked like. You see so many period films where all the costumes and the hair and the makeup, everything's really sanitized and perfect. We just covered Apollo 13, which I actually think also did a great job of this, but even they still had housewives raising several children that were in full makeup with beehive hairdos every time you saw them on camera, which, let's face it, realistically, that is not what these women would have looked like on a day-to-day basis.
I could see a NASA wife doing that.
If you're going to be in front of camera, sure, but when you have kids to raise, your husband isn't even there to see what you look like today. You're putting your hair in a ponytail. You're not putting makeup on. Ask any woman who's been in this quarantine. You know, I've put on makeup twice since March. I just don't wear makeup anymore.
Stupid pandemic. Stupid pandemic.
My hair gets blow-dried once every 2 weeks. Other than that, I just throw it in a braid and call it a day. That's how real people live. My point being that when you leave the ugliness in, when you let his girlfriend, Donna, have these corny bangs that look like she wore a curler overnight.
She's cute at best. Daniel Von Zernick is not a babe. She's okay looking.
Yeah, but he's okay looking, right? Well, that's not true. Luke Diamond Phillips is kind of foxy, but you buy them. Although I will find one of the flaws of the film, they didn't have a ton of chemistry as a couple.
She's not that good. Maybe that's the problem.
Maybe that's the problem.
She still has made some TV and she's still alive too. But her last movie was 25 years ago. Living in Oblivion. She's in that. We like that movie quite a bit.
Oh, yeah. Is she the stage manager?
I forget. Maybe. I don't remember.
The uptight blonde?
But nothing in 25 years. Could be her choice. Could be that it's a sexist thing. But it also could be, and you said this about the girl in To Die For. Maybe they don't think she's very good. That was the same year. Maybe they don't think she's very good.
Yeah, maybe she just doesn't really have the talent to pull it off. And I said stage manager, and I have to correct myself. She was the assistant director. I can't believe I said that.
Okay.
Stage manager is not a job on set. A detail I did like about their relationship, and again, verisimilitude, this felt like something I lived when I saw it, which is that they don't seem to be having sex. They're two young kids. They're teenagers. But
intense
they make
kissing.
Out so hard. I remember making out like that when making out was where it stopped. And you would do it in a car with the top down. You didn't care if people were watching because you were like, well, I can't do it at home. I have to go somewhere. And you just want to kiss your boyfriend so bad. I really like the way they portrayed that.
The odds are he was raised Catholic, so no and, condoms.
Yeah. She certainly had uptight parents, and it was the 50s.
Sam Anderson. So many things he's done, but Forrest Gump, one of the things you got to think about with him, because of course that's an AFI movie and we covered it and it's a huge hit and everything, but he's barely in the movie, but it's a very memorable scene he had or a couple scenes he had in Forrest Gump.
And of course, Ryan, he is. I'm waiting for you to say, because it's your favorite show. He's Bernard in Lost.
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah. The Simpsons is my favorite show, but
okay.
Lost is up there.
Lost is up there. You like Lost a lot.
You mentioned verisimilitude. Well, the reality of the film is that, yes, two planes did crash, and every one of those planes died when they did, and kids died from the wreckage in a school playground. And, of course, that's the way the movie starts. They keep on going back to Richie's nightmares, him witnessing that, but he wasn't there, and his best friend dies, so he feels guilt, and he also feels fear. It's almost like, it's coming for me, too. It's almost like Final Destination. It's going to get me at some point. I could have done without that, maybe entirely, or certainly not as much as they do show. Because if you know anything about this real story where he died in a plane crash, you don't need the foreshadowing, I don't think, exactly. I didn't hate it, but I didn't think I really needed that. And that's also
like that detail.
It's an auspicious way to start a movie, though. The very first scene is a plane crash, and then this portly young Mexican kid or Mexican-American kid getting squashed by wreckage from a plane and waking up to a start as he did.
It didn't bother me that they had this foreshadowing. How do you tell this kid's life story without the shadow of his tragic young death?
Well, who's to say that Richie felt that way in reality, necessarily?
Well, he was afraid of flying. Isn't that a real detail?
Well, I suppose so, probably. They could have made
it up. Did lose his best friend in that tragic accident, so.
Richie had an 8-month career. That's it. Died at 17. That was February 3rd, 1959, when Holly, Bopper, and Valens, and of course the pilot, all died the day the music died. American Pie, I believe, is where that came from.
That whole song is really about, well, it's about the whole era of music.
It's a good song, but that's a little melodramatic. Except, too bad Big Bopper died, of course. The character in this movie does remind you often who he is. Hello, baby.
Yeah, that was maybe one of the phonier elements.
Says it about 12 times.
Like, is that really how this person talked? I find that hard to believe.
And it's too bad, of course, that Richie died because he already had 3 really good songs and 3 hits. God knows how many more he might have had. He might have been a gigantic player in the business.
You have that much talent when you're that young.
But the real loss was Buddy Holly. There's that line in American Graffiti. Rock and roll's been going downhill ever since Buddy Holly died. I don't know if that's really true, but he is somebody much like Kurt Cobain who didn't even need to play music anymore at some point in his career. He could have been a producer if he had never sung a song, although he wouldn't have gotten into business, I guess. But if he had lived to be 45, 50, well, 45 is young too, but 65, 70 years old, I think he would have been a giant in the industry. Richie Valens got into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2001. But that's a long time after he died, and for only 3 songs. But again, Holly's the one I look at and say, oh, it's too bad any of them died, but especially him. Tommy Alsup is the one who lost the coin toss to Richie. And Marshall Crenshaw, who plays Buddy Holly, says, Alsup, call it, or something like that. He was Buddy Holly's guitarist. And Waylon Jennings, this is such a sad story, he lost his seat to the Big Bopper. Jennings, who's a pretty well-known name in country music, and Alsup were in Holly's band. But I guess the idea was, well, Big Bopper outranks you, and then the other two are going to flip for it. The kid, meaning Richie, and Alsup will flip for it. that Jennings lost his seat, and apparently he said to Big Bopper, "I hope you crash." And that apparently haunted him, as it would. It would haunt me for the rest of my life if I said that to somebody, even if I completely meant it as a joke, even if he laughed at me when I said it, and we shook hands and hugged and everything like that, and then he died, I would never get over that, and I'm sure he didn't for a very long time.
There is also the line in the movie, who knows if he actually said this, Richie Valens is like, "I never win coin tosses." Oh, sweetie, you didn't win anything. Oh, there's also the foreshadowing. I made a joke when we saw this that made you laugh. They go to Mexico, they go to Tijuana, and the medicine man, I don't know.
The snake man.
The snake guy gives him the necklace that's like a...
Talisman.
Talisman, thank you. And then when he gets in his fight with Bob, right before he leaves for his ill-fated, he rips. Oh no, I needed that to live, it turns out. It's the corny movie thing. Oh, your good luck charm. I sure hope nothing bad happens. Everyone in the audience knows that the worst thing possible is going to happen. And Bob will have guilt for the rest of his life, regardless.
Well, at least they made their peace. Because after that big fight, when Bob is sober, he's had a few drinks of beer, unless he's lying to us. But I don't think he is. He says he's been on the wagon. He doesn't look like he's very happy at that party, not drinking when everyone else is. But they had the fight when Bob looks like he's sober. He tears off the talisman. It's like in Troy, when the guy kills Brad Pitt's cousin and probably lover, and as soon as that happens, they all realize, oh whoa, that's big. Achilles is gonna be mad. Okay, see ya, we'll get back to this tomorrow. Stop dead, the fight is over. Well, just like this, when he rips off the talisman, the fight is over. But Bob's the one who told Richie how much this talisman was supposed to mean, so he realizes why that's a big deal. He pulled it off. But one of the nice touches is during their last conversation on the phone, he's got the talisman, he's using it as a little toy for their baby, and he's taking care of the kid. He's finally becoming a father. He seems like he is on the wagon, if not again. I guess if you take two sips of beer, does that count as going off the wagon? I guess it does. So he's back on the wagon again. They have such a nice conversation, one of the best moments in the whole film. But I do have a question, because Richie wants Bob to meet him in Chicago to finish out the tour. Richie, by the way, with Bopper and Holly, were going to Minnesota when they crashed in Clear Lake, Iowa. What a terrible place to die, Iowa, for this kid from Southern California. Pacoima.
To our Iowa listeners, I apologize on Ryan's behalf.
Well, for him to be in the snow and everything. And I have a question about this. Bob doesn't confirm he's going to fly to Chicago to meet Richie. Do you think he was really going to?
I don't think it matters. The point is that Richie reached out. It was an olive branch. And whether or not Bob took it, the spirit of it.
Well, Bob does say, "I'm still your brother."
Yeah.
Okay. I just wondered about that because he doesn't say yes to meeting him in Chicago.
If he did meet him in Chicago, he probably would have gotten drunk and punched somebody and ruined things again. Because I don't think that fight would have been the last fight for them. He's not the bad guy of the film by any means, but it's not a real flattering portrait of this person who's living and probably needed to co-sign this story getting told in some level.
Yeah, the family was involved. Connie is in the big party scene. She's the one with the camera filming this. Probably a little 16mm camera back in the 50s, I guess it would have had to have been. The sisters may not have been in the movie, but they definitely were on set because apparently when they shot the plane scene, the one daughter had to be almost restrained. "Richie, why did you get on the plane?"
No.
To Lou Diamond Phillips.
And they loved him, apparently, and they called him Richie.
Meaning they love Lou.
Yeah, that's what I mean to say.
Of course they love their actual brother, yeah. Well, you brought up about Bob's drinking and the way he treats his wife and everyone on the wagon, off the wagon. Let's do what happens next. Part of this is not about him, but the other part is. So what happens next to Donna? She marries the blonde preppy her parents would prefer, and everyone is happy. Although maybe she finds another Hispanic rock star in her school and marries him. There's a lot of those in the school, right? And as for Bob, he goes to jail for abusing his wife. Wait, he's a man, so this continues.
Oh, yes, the 50s, first of all. Oh, and they are not white, second of all. Yeah, that's just not going to happen.
So it's pretty dark what happens next.
I should say she's not white. He's not going to get arrested for that. I think it's probably the story of a lot of marriages, but it was a lot easier to get away with in 1959.
Mm-hmm. When we first see Bob, he rides in his motorcycle to Bo Diddley's "Who Do You Love?" I thought actually it was Ronnie Hawkins, because he sings it, I think, in The Last Waltz. I feel like he does. But I guess it's Bo Diddley. That's a little on the nose, too, because I guess in a way it's referring to Connie, "Who Do You Love More?" Then again, brothers and sisters, or brothers and brothers, with parents, they're going to have these kinds of conflicts. And I have, in a way, had that with my sister in a big fight we had a couple years ago. That was an element of it, without a doubt. But "Who Do You Love?" is very much on the nose. But this movie is a bit on the nose, like the talisman scene where it gets ripped off. And, oh my God, what does this mean?
And just Bob's whole conflict is that, truthfully, he's jealous. He loves Richie so much, mm-hmm. but he can't tolerate that he is just so much better at life and he's so much younger. Because it's not even just that he's talented and that he's finding success. It's that Richie just seems to have his act together. People love him, and for good reason. He seems like the loveliest dude. So all those things make Bob feel insecure about himself. And maybe I can do drawings, but he doesn't have the patience for it, or success doesn't come fast and easy enough for him. So it frustrates him.
Yeah, he breaks his drafting board and tears the pictures off the wall. Doesn't mean he'll never do it again, but that's the last time we see him in any way with his drawings.
Which is a shame, because it's probably easier to make a living as a cartoonist. That's an employable job.
Especially back when newspapers were such a thing.
Yeah, easier to do that than to be a rock star.
Mm-hmm. And I guess in reality, he found Disney cartoons because they were on the Disney lot. But because it's a Columbia movie, it ends up being Woody Woodpecker, who's also very famous and iconic. No one needs to tell you who Woody Woodpecker is when you see that panel.
For a minute, when they were doing that scene and then he talks about entering the drawing contest, I thought he was passing those drawings off as his own. I thought that was his angle that he was doing to win money. And it took me forever before I was like, oh, no, he really did the drawings. It wasn't just a hustle.
Well, Richie asks him, did you trace these? Trace nothing. This is freehand. I don't know why he'd lie to Richie in that moment. He doesn't seem like a liar exactly. He seems like a pretty honest person. Bob is often shitty, but he does love and sometimes supports his brother. He draws posters, and this is a bit of a setup. I don't know if it's on the nose exactly. It's a nice little foreshadowing because he beaks off about how bad they're drawing the posters, and he's not wrong. They're pretty bad. But then he ends up drawing pretty good ones, and that is a foreshadowing to him being an artist later on for the big gig he has, which Bob ends up ruining by getting really drunk and starting a fight. Nice moment, though, that Richie, during it, I'm sure later on he was mad about it, but in the moment, well, I may be playing this show, and this is a big break for me and my band, The Silhouettes, but I got to go help my brother. And he gets into a fight too and stupidly uses his right hand to punch somebody. Didn't listen to Crash Davis and Bull Durham the next year that movie came out. You don't punch a drunk with your pitching hand, or in this case, your guitaring hand. I guess he needs both hands to guitar, doesn't he?
I think it's implied that Bob is sabotaging his show, partly because he's jealous of his mother's attention as well. And she is working day and night to promote this show. She's so obsessed with Richie's career at this point.
Richard Valenzuela and his flying guitar.
Yeah.
Nice moment that the sisters and Richie all laugh at that. Little tiny thing with the family, where they're not just saying, Mom's got it. They realize that's a little bit stupid.
Yeah, but then they but still sweet. Go with it. That's still the name of his band at that time.
Well, he is with the Silhouettes first, and the sax player's not happy about how good Richie is. A little bit envious,
too. They almost overkill how bad the sax player is, how bad his voice is, and how he's not even a particularly good saxophonist.
And he does later quit, but I like how those other guys stand by him because they just want to play music. But then Richie ends up bailing on them, and this is a scene from this movie I've always remembered so much. I remember so much of this movie because I've seen it lots of times, but the scene when Bobbo, Joey Pants' character, is named Bob Keane. His real name is Bob Coon, he says, but Bob Keane, well, Bob, brother, pseudo-brother, calls him Bobbo. Maybe that's to differentiate the two as well. But when Bob Keane puts him to the test and says, well, I don't really want to use your band. It's you or nothing. So what's it going to be, your friends or your music? Richie puts down his cheap amp and says, my family.
Which means your music, which means where the money goes. That's actually a nice way that it breaks away from the typical biopic where that would be a big moment of conflict. They would write a scene like that into a movie that never even happened in real life.
We never see that band again either.
No, they're gone. He just ditches them.
Maybe they're mad at him. Maybe they're not. But they're not in the story anymore. And they don't need to be. We don't really care about them. They seem like nice enough guys. As you point out, though, the one guy, maybe the drummer, looks like he's at least three times their age.
Oh, see, it's the other guitarist, and he looks like everybody's dad. He is two-thirds bald.
I have a solution for this problem. He was held back in school 12 times.
And again, it's a detail where Richie is supposed to be 16 years old, 17 years old, and then he's playing with these people that look older than his teachers and his parents, certainly older than his mother, who I think she was only 12 years older than them, playing his mother.
The actress, yeah.
The actress, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you agree with me that Isai Morales is the best thing in the whole film, with respect to Lou Diamond Phillips, who's excellent as Richie?
No, I would vote Lou Diamond Phillips. Okay, I really love his
heart.
But
you think Isai Morales is really good, though?
Yeah, he's wonderful. Okay. Their relationship is everything.
So obviously the performance is great, but the character's not so great. He is a bad person in a lot of ways, but then he has his moments where he's a good person.
He's a flawed person, yeah.
But an interesting movie character. Again, maybe that was what Valdez brought to this, that Hackford might not have, or a typical Hollywood director might not have, although Hackford's done some complicated films, too. But Bob does rape Rosie when he's drunk and obnoxious. While Connie's sleeping in the house next door because they're in the camper, meaning Bob and Rosie are.
And it's scary. He bursts into that room. He breaks the door down. It's kind of like a horror moment.
But when Rosie goes off with them from the workers' camp, she gets on the back of his bike. Now, she's already cheated on Richie, who she was with, I guess. He was at least sweet on her, whether or not they had any kind of relationship at all. But she gets on Bob's bike, and whatever it was, supposed to be days or weeks before, where she had a fling with him, maybe many times had a fling with him. But I don't really blame her, because what has she got in that workers' camp? Her dad may be upset about it, but she's better off going to Pacoima with them to have some kind of possible future. And she doesn't know that Bob's going to be this kind of person.
It's hard to say where her life would have been worse. And this is me pleading ignorance about all kinds of things, beginning with what life in a migrant farming camp is like and what life with her father was like. But I presume eventually Bob is going to screw up enough that he's going to be gone and she'll be left with Connie, with the mom.
And Brenda.
And Brenda.
What a strange name for a Hispanic baby.
Oh, I know. But that might be a happy life for her. Certainly better than farming. At least they have electricity. And Connie's just so lovely. They have such a nice family there.
Treat her like another daughter.
Bob is really the problem. To say he's a terrible husband doesn't really do justice to what he does to her. That's always a trigger for me. Rape, domestic abuse, stuff like that. But the movie's not asking us to sympathize with Bob either. It's asking us to see his flaws exactly the way they are. And of course, Richie loves him anyway. He's a teenager. That's his big brother. And they stand in relief of one another as well. And that's part of the conflict of the film. It's very well drawn. That
it feels so real. Yeah, it feels authentic again. And one of the best moments in the film, too, is at the very end when they find out that their brother and son died through the radio. Maybe that's the way it was in the late 50s. You found out on the radio that your family member died. Now you have to be called. I think that's just, if it's not an absolute law, I don't think it's a law. It's probably just courtesy at this point.
I remember this being a thing when Kobe Bryant died. People were talking about a helicopter crash, and they criticized media because even though they didn't name who the people in the helicopter were, they knew that the Bryant family were in this helicopter. There was some detail about that that just made it obvious that anyone who knew them would know that their helicopter went down, and so people figured it out just from what the news did report about it. Listen, man, the media will jump on a story like that, and they don't want to wait till the family's informed. They just want to get that story.
And it's Rick Dees, who's an actual DJ, who's barely ever in movies, but is in this. I don't think they call him Rick Dees, but he's playing a DJ in the movie, and of course he is a DJ in reality. Pretty sure it's his voice that they hear over the radio that says, these three rock stars died, and Bob's fixing the car. And in that short period of time, he's still on the wagon. Well, it's only supposed to be the next day after he talked to Richie on the phone. But the best moment in the whole movie, maybe for Rosanna DeSoto, is a very painful one. The reaction she has when she throws the laundry in the air, very touching stuff. And Bob is there when his mother needs him the most.
Yeah, it's a really sweet moment. She collapses into his arms and they have each other. And whatever his flaws are and how much conflict there is in their relationship, they are the two people in the world that loved Richie the most. And even doesn't Donna find out in class?
A classmate tells her, yeah.
Oh my God.
And it reminds me of a movie the year before this, one of my favorites, Stand By Me, where in a dream, it's not real, but in a dream, Gordy hears his father say to him, it should have been you, rather than John Cusack's character. And Connie didn't say it in that moment, and maybe she felt it, maybe she didn't, but she had to be thinking it at some point, which is, I don't want either of my sons to die. And I guess she has a third son. We see him at one point, don't really see him a lot in the movie. It seems to be just the younger sisters, but you do see a young kid who I think is supposed to be another son. But if she was ever actually being honest with herself, she would say, if I had to lose anybody, it should be the bad kid who was already doing things wrong, was in jail and everything else.
She the probably alcoholic. Was already a little mentally prepared for him to...
That wouldn't have been a shock to her.
Yeah.
Also, it's interesting that Steve is not Bob's father, but he seemed to revere him maybe almost as much as Richie did. And it says Steve drank himself to death.
I read online on BuzzFeed.
Well, the movie said that.
So, the movie said that, but according to BuzzFeed, take that as you will, I can't remember how they said he died, but it was not drinking. It was natural causes. Prematurely, yeah, but he didn't drink himself to death.
Okay. As for Joey Pants, who'd been in plenty of movies at this point already, The Goonies was a couple years before this, and of course we've covered in The Matrix and Memento and stuff. This is one of his rare nice guy roles, and one of the nicest nice guy roles he could ever have. He seems to legitimately like the Valenzuelas. He's at the big party when Richie comes home. He hugs the sisters and holds one of them in his arms at that moment. Then when they get the house, he's there too. He's still picking a sister up. But it's not just, yes, this is my client and I like him and I sort of know your family. I'll pretend like I like you. It seems like he actually does. Maybe the real guy didn't. But this version of Bob Keane really liked this family, not just the meal ticket.
And it's another way that this movie breaks the mold from music biopics, where it's such an easy, cheap conflict to have the musician fighting against the label always and their producers always. But no, they actually seem to have a nice relationship, and he discovers him and he mentors him and he makes his record a hit. And they have a nice relationship. It's all right.
Come On, Let's Go was the first hit Richie had. And then the pizza party scene where they're all getting records before they're getting pizza, really. One of the things about this movie I like a lot, too, is it's not just Richie's music. You hear other great tunes. Jackie Wilson has a couple of great tunes, and you see him portrayed in this film. He's the black guy at the Alan Freed Showcase when you first hear La Bamba be played by Richie. Eddie Cochran is portrayed in this movie as well. Brian Setzer, who's an actual musician, plays him. Again, a guy didn't act very much like Rick Dees, but he's in this movie as Eddie Cochran. The woman who plays whatever she is, girlfriend, wife, they all come out and they watch him playing La Bamba. You talked about people not being exceptionally beautiful and that's more authentic. She was beautiful. So Luis Valdez's team was Adam Greenberg shooting the movie as a cinematographer. Don Brochu and Sheldon Kahn were the editors. And Miles Goodman did the music. The movie is 185:1. We watched the DVD. I saw that it's actually on Crave on demand. We probably should have watched that because I'm sure the print would be that much better. But this looked okay considering this movie that I own is really old. You can tell by some of the DVD features, meaning the way the DVD loads up. You don't see that anymore with DVD or Blu-ray. So I think I bought this movie a long time ago. I forget when. But I think it looked okay. Adam Greenberg shot Terminator and Terminator 2, but also we just recently covered Ghost. And then Brochu cut The Fugitive a couple years later, which is a terrific action film. Sheldon Kahn cut Cuckoo's Nest and Ghostbusters. We've covered both of those. And then Miles Goodman worked on Little Shop of Horrors. I think it was the year before this. Carlos Santana also had a composing credit on this. And this is the only composing credit he ever had. Carlos Santana, the famous guitarist. What'd you think of the look, the editing, and the music that is not, of course, the actual songs we know from all these musicians, including the big one, Richie Valens?
Cinematography doesn't stand out that much. But I'll say again, I really loved how much they got into those small spaces and they showed the world the way it probably looked.
What about the pace?
Pace is excellent. Mm-hmm. This movie goes by really quickly. When you think about it, there's not that much story, really. So it's like a magic trick to keep it as entertaining and watchable as it is. And it absolutely is. The score doesn't get in its own way, which is what I'll say for that. It has a couple of big dramatic moments, especially when they're doing the flashbacks. But I liked it fine. I almost wish that they had used more of those hits from the 50s, more real rock and roll music, but that could have been a budgetary thing. The movie's budget was pretty small, and those songs probably did still cost a lot of money to put in a movie back in 87.
I don't know if it's Lonely Teardrops that Jackie Wilson plays, but that's a great tune. And then Buddy Holly sings Crying. Eddie Cochran, I forget what his song is.
But and of course, you've got Sleepwalk, which is one of my all-time favorite couple of times. Classic 50s. I don't even know if you call that a rock and roll song. It's kind of a surf tune.
You know, things are happening outside. The storm we've had today is maybe going away. People are starting to do stuff. So let's wrap it up. This is the right time to wrap up anyway. What are your last thoughts on La Bamba?
I'm so glad we watched this one. It surprised me how sweet and sincere it is and how much I found myself caring about Richie and his family. And I kept thinking about it. It really stuck with me. It's just a lovely film. It's not reinventing anything, but it was terrific.
Well, it's a somber and touching movie. I'm impressed Hollywood let Valdez make his movie about Hispanics really be about Hispanics, because it mostly is. Now, they're not all Hispanic actors, I guess. Especially the main guy. But you also have to get a talented enough actor. He was in Stand and Deliver the year after this, incidentally, with Rosanna DeSoto. She's in that, too.
She probably only got greenlit because of this movie's success. Along with a few other films.
On the poster of that, and yet it is Edward James Olmos, who is the star and got nominated for an Oscar, but it's Lou Diamond Phillips on the poster of that movie, based on the success of La Bamba. But it's still relatable to those of us who aren't Hispanic is the big thing with this, too. This movie's extremely relatable, which is another reason why people should get past this, yeah, but they're whatever, if it be a woman thing or
white people aren't
gay
gonna see this movie,
or
yeah.
Hispanic or Asian, whatever it is, they'll never watch this movie. That's simply not true many times over, and this is one of the many examples of that because it was a success. And if you say you root for underdogs, which so many people do, so many Americans certainly do, then you damn well better root for this family. How do you not? All Our Dreams Are Gonna Come True, Mijos, when Bob's won an art contest and Richie's moving ahead in his music. That's one of the nice moments in the movie, too, because she hugs them both. She's proud of them both. Yeah, it's more Richie, but she's actually proud of Bob for once, too. You have to root for those kinds of people. If you don't, then you are a racist dick. And it's also easy to love Richie's three hits. And it's one of those movies I'll certainly watch again one of these days. Well, in 7 days, we'll cover a movie that pretty much has to be covered in the middle of summer, Midsummer. Some people call it Midsommar, and we'll probably do both of those words next week. But Midsummer, I think is how it's just supposed to be pronounced.
I'm going to find the most pretentious pronunciation that I can come up with and use strictly that.
Midsummer! So the coming attractions opinion. I got to find some more trivia questions. We had one this week, but it was pretty easy to look it up. But anyway, Florence Pugh is one of the best young actresses we've seen in a while.
Pew pew!
She starred in 3 movies last year, 2019. In which of these does she give her best performance? What is your opinion on that one? I've probably said this before for those who listen to us all the time. I'm sure they've heard it. But we'll discuss that more thoroughly next week on Midsummer.
All right. So for our answers to that question, check out next week's podcast about Midsommar. Midsommar. And in the meantime, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. Hundreds of episodes are available for free, and that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 lists of the best American films ever made, and hundreds more titles on top of that. In exchange for all this great content, perchance, you could leave us a rating and a review that helps people find us. We're both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51, or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. We always love to hear from you guys. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you in Canada or the US, please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code TOP100PROJECT, and that's all one word, TOP100PROJECT. It's not case sensitive, and that will get you a 20% discount.
Less spark plug coffee. Oh, Bevy. Oh, Bevy. And this podcast. And this podcast.
And cut.